I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Meacham is joining us this hour of the program, and we'll be talking about what's going on in the presidential race. And we'll also talk about other presidents and their advice for future presidents about what it takes to be a president, what you need to know. Actually, John did a very interesting piece in July in Time magazine, What a President Needs to Know. Amid the clamor of advisors and the fog of hard calls, some basic requirements remain. What are they? John is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his 2008 biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion. Most recently, he's the author of Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. And he's going to be in Milwaukee at Boswell Books on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock to talk about that book and about the election, I'm sure, as well. It's now out in paperback. He's executive editor at Random House, also author of the New York Times bestsellers Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Gospel, Franklin and Winston. He teaches at Vanderbilt University and the University of the South. He is a fellow of the Society of American Historians, and we're delighted to have him with us to talk about a wide range of issues this hour. John Meacham, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. That could be my eulogy. I appreciate it.
Oh, you've only just begun, right?
We can just wrap it up.
Actually, Ann Patchett was on the show last week, and she was singing your praises, just so you know that. Oh. She's a delightful person.
And she has done a great public service, not only as a wonderful novelist, but as a bookseller, advocate, and we love her.
Yeah.
And I have to keep Anne on my side because her husband is my doctor.
Oh, is he really? I didn't know that.
Town.
Well, you're definitely on her side. I can attest to that most definitely.
Oh, thank you.
Well, before we talk about George Herbert Walker Bush, let's talk about this election for a moment. It's been such, as you know, a wild, wild week. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about what the FBI has done here with this investigation into emails and now a release of more emails yesterday, information on a pardon that Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton gave.
Yeah.
Are they playing politics here? Does it make sense that they let us know that this is being done? There are people on the other side saying, what about the investigation of the possible Trump advisor or Trump ties to Russia? It really is changing the election.
Right, it is. And you know, we always have a couple of weeks of October surprises. They really started in 1968. When President Johnson announced a bombing halt, which was seen as a move to help Humphrey against Nixon. 1972, Henry Kissinger goes to the White House briefing room and says, peace is at hand. In 1992, Lawrence Walsh re-indicted Caspar Weinberger. At the last minute, hurting George H.W. Bush. 2000, there was a story about George W. Bush and an old DUI. 2004, Osama bin Laden issued a tape that was seen as helpful to Bush as opposed to Kerry. There's a historical pattern here. In this case, it seems to me that Director Comey was trying to clean up something that had been an oversight from the beginning. They had not thoroughly checked where various emails might be. I think that he really, my own view, and I'm not a lawyer, is that he probably had no choice here because if he had suppressed it, you would have had the Republicans after the election saying that he had done so. I tend to agree with Secretary Clinton when she said in her first statement on this that a lot of the reaction to news like this at this point is baked in. I think if you're for Secretary Clinton, you probably realize the email thing was a mistake, but probably not dispositive. If you're against her, this just motivates you more. You hate to see the FBI in any sort of politicalization. But, you know, it's a political, I hate to say it, but it's also a political office. You know, J. Edgar Hoover ruled tyrannically for decades. So I like to think that, I guess my main hope here is that whatever happens next Tuesday, that the result is accepted by both sides. And we can press forward.
Well, that could be problematic for people to accept it. I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to happen if she is elected, if government will be able to function, because you have all these calls for investigation after investigation. You can pretty much be assured that's going to happen, can't you?
Oh, yeah, because the House will remain Republican no matter what. But, you know, this is not the first time we've seen this movie, is it? So for 25 years, the Clintons have been investigated and investigated and investigated. Those investigations have taken up an enormous amount of political oxygen. And yet he was a very successful two-term president, fondly looked back on by many people. And she's on the cusp of becoming the first female president of the United States. So in the end, what has this really done? And what it has done, to answer my own rhetorical question, is chipped away at the broad public trust in her as a person. And so to go directly to your point, there will be a governance question. She will be an unpopular president from the first moment if she becomes president. And it's very hard to see how one builds trust given the polarized climate in which we live. Even George W. Bush, had slightly better numbers on trustworthiness coming out of the ferocious recount of, mm-hmm. of 2000. So it's going to be hard. And, my own view about Secretary Clinton is that fundamentally she's an incrementalist. She's more of a centrist Democrat than a left-wing Democrat. I think that's partly attributable to the fact that for 18 years she lived in Arkansas as sort of the blue dot in a state that was becoming rapidly more conservative. And she and her husband had to learn how to survive politically in that climate. And what happened in Arkansas as a microcosm in the 80s happened to the country, big parts of the country, in the 90s when they were in the White House.
Let's move on to Donald Trump. He wrote an interesting piece in the New York Times not very long ago, Nostalgia for the Grace of George Herbert Walker Bush. You've spent a lot of time, many years, and we talked with you about that book, a really great read. I wasn't aware of this. About to choose a running mate, Bush's campaign manager, who was a hard-hitting guy, Lee Atwater, apparently had informal talks with Donald J. Trump.
Right. This popped up in Vice President Bush's diary, and no way had reported it before. And I was reading along, and Atwater comes to Bush right after Bush has sealed up the nomination against Bob Dole and says that Trump would be willing to be considered to be vice president. And Bush, in his diary, said, strange, unbelievable, and moved on. But it's a reminder, and there's a really fine PBS Frontline called The Choice out.
Yes, wasn't that good?
Really good. Those are always good, mm-hmm. This one was particularly. But that footage of him, of Trump, going to New Hampshire in 88, and sort of looking around. I mean, this didn't pop up out of nowhere. I do think that at the risk of being sentimental, the movement from George H.W. Bush to Trump is a remarkable deep descent in terms of the caliber of the experience of Republican nominees. My joke about it is it disproves Darwin. And I just think that the Republican Party is going to have to figure out what they believe, what they profess, what they want to represent in the life of the country. And I think that task becomes infinitely harder if the man wins. Mm-hmm. If he loses, at least you can say we're rebuilding. If this happens and somehow or another Donald Trump becomes president, the Republican Party is going to be captive, for at least that number of years and probably beyond.
You say in that Times piece that George Herbert Walker Bush, a 92-year-old, for the first time ever, will vote for the Democratic nominee.
That's right. He has he said privately he's going to vote for Hillary. Excuse me. He could still change his mind, of course. But my strong sense is that's what he will do. He first voted in 1948 for Tom Dewey. Has never voted for a Democratic presidential nominee. And one of the things I love about this is only in American history could you have a former president voting for the wife of the man who sent him into a forced retirement.
Exactly.
It's Falcon Crest meets C-SPAN. it's hard to believe. But I think here's why I think he's doing it. President Bush, for all his manifold sins and weaknesses and all that, wants to be judged on to what extent he put the country first. To what extent did he put the interests of the nation as he saw them, not necessarily as you saw them or as I saw them, but as he saw them first. And my strong sense is that he believes that Trump's narcissism, Trump's lack of seriousness about the office would mean that Trump was putting Trump first at every point and not the country first. And that would be so damaging to the republic that that he's breaking with a lifetime of partisan loyalty.
In reflecting on how the Republican Party got to where it is after incredible number of conversations over the last year and a half, which is a long time to have an election, you talk about culture. Let's spend a little time talking about culture. You write, while we live in an age of Twitter-fed self-promotion and self-assertion, George Herbert Walker Bush believed in reticence and in dignity. Do you think that we downplay the importance of how the culture has changed, that this, reality television, I must admit, I don't watch that very much. And so the fact that Donald Trump, everybody knew who he was. I knew who he was, but not from reality television, because I don't watch it. But this Twitter, this self-promotion, this, television star, this whole culture that we're living in, does it give rise, and is it an important reason that Donald Trump got to the top of the pack?
Unquestionably. I mean, culture and politics are inextricably intertwined. The means of communication of a given era have always been essential to successful political leadership. Jefferson and Lincoln both wrote quickly and well for newspapers. Roosevelt and Churchill mastered the radio. So did Adolf Hitler. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the ledger. John Kennedy, Ronald Reagan understood television. Barack Obama understood the internet world early on, at least in terms of turning out voters. And Bill Clinton understood cable television in an important way. Clinton, in a way that both recognized the rise of cable and the intersection of celebrity with politics, in the sense of, when Bill Clinton went and played the saxophone on Arsenio Hall, Bush was done. I mean, Bush thought Arsenio Hall was a building in Andover. He had no idea. And it's also impossible to imagine Ross Perot without Larry King, without the rise of CNN. Mm-hmm. He announced his candidacy on cable TV. So all that, I think, is sort of familiar to us, and I think, therefore, it's a really natural next step that that someone out of the genre of TV that again, I don't watch it either, and you don't watch it, but that's one of the reasons we're probably surprised by it more than we should be. But a lot of people do. And for 14 years, he was in the top 10, I guess, of network shows. Roger Stone, his consigliere, pointed out that one of the reasons Trump was plausible is that he had sat in a boardroom on The Apprentice in a high back chair making decisions. And that for a lot of people, that's what presidents do. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a hell of an interesting observation. So, yes, it absolutely matters. And what's slightly different is that before this year, you had politicians who were adapting to the techniques of the culture. And in this year, we have a creature of the culture adapting to the techniques of politics.
You wrote a really interesting piece that appeared in late July in Time magazine, What a President Needs to Know. And I want to reflect a little bit on some of what you wrote. Fundamentally, you wrote, the Clinton-Trump race will be a campaign of the conventional versus the confident, of the prepared versus the provocateur, of the realist versus the ringmaster. It may turn out that Trump is better suited to the politics of the moment, not just to the convention, but through the autumn to the general election. And then you cite what's happened, the Brexit vote in the UK, the elites of all kinds, governing, corporate, intellectual, are facing a withering populist backlash.
That's where we are. I mean, that's the political moment that has created it. My way of putting it is that two numbers explain why Donald Trump is the Republican nominee. One is 19%. Only 19% of Americans trust the federal government to do the right thing some or most of the time. That's down from 77% in the middle of the 1960s. Hmm. So we've gone from three quarters of Americans to trusting Washington to fewer than one in five. So that's the gasoline on the garage floor. And the match is, this is a metaphor within a metaphor, forgive me. The match is, the White House estimates that it requires $135,000 a year in household income to have a middle class life, in the way we would think of it as in the post World War II era. The average average household income today is $57,500. So in that missing $73,000 or so is the match on this distrust. And people feel they have been denied the equality of opportunity. They don't think they're going to leave their kids better off. They're worried about their jobs. They are willing to blame anybody and anything for the disappearance of those jobs. And who can blame them? It's an existential crisis if you are out of work and can't find anything. And so if a champion rides onto the field who says, I alone will fix it, I will make the country great again, I will make your life great again, no wonder he's doing as well as he is.
Mm. Let's talk about what he knows. You were with him, and
that will be a brief conversation.
Well, maybe not. You have kind of an insider view here. He talked with you a lot about intuition. He did talk about some books that he's reading right now. Please discuss what those are. And this fact that he has great intuition. You know, he doesn't need all the history necessarily because he really can sense what's going on. He gets a read. What does he read? What does he consume? And can you, do you think, be a president who maybe doesn't know a whole lot about history but has really good intuition?
Well, you need both, unfortunately. And I think what Mr. Trump was very honest with me. I appreciated his candor. You know, he said, you know, I don't read, you know, the kinds of big history books that you do. You know, I'm a businessman. I work. You know, I talk to a lot of people. My sense of how the information flow works is that it's almost like policy hearsay. He'll pick something up on the internet. He'll pick something up from the Wall Street Journal. He'll pick something up from the Times. He'll get in his brain for a while. Someone will tell him something. He does talk to people a lot. And he doesn't have, by his own admission, he doesn't have decades of experience or a catalog of context in which to judge that information as it comes in. Now, his argument is that if experts were so great, you know, as he put it in the debates a couple of times, you know, she's been doing this for 30 years. Mm-hmm. You know, if experts were so great, then why do we have the problems we have? A very compelling populist argument. And so I don't dismiss that. But when I went to see him about what does a president need to know, what do you read, what's the incoming information, it was really clear to me that he is a news consumer. He's not a book consumer. He has read, I think, the Bill O'Reilly books. I believe he read Ed Klein's book on the Clintons, which is a quite hostile tome. There's a book about the rise of ISIS that he told me he had read. He said that he had, at various points, read biographies of different presidents, but that was a little fuzzy. So I think that, you know, he's not, and I will say this for him, he's not pretending to be something he's not. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't, a lot of people, if you do what I do and you're a politician and I walk in, they say, oh, I read your book on X.
Right.
And I know they're sort of fibbing and they know that I know they're fibbing, but we all participate in sort of a polite fiction. There was no fiction. I mean, he told me, he said, I haven't read your books, but I like you on TV. And I really kind of appreciated the candor.
I understand.
Well, everybody else, you know, blows smoke and Trump just told it like it was, you know. And so it was interesting. I guess the thing that historically we'll have to answer, depending on what happens now, blessedly in 6 days, is if could he have more convincingly and more conscientiously be taken on the conventions of politics? That is, could he have made a move from this tabloid champion outsider who does away with 16 other people, you know, if in April or May he had decided to run a more traditional campaign, even in terms of organization, if he had not joked about Second Amendment people taking care of Hillary Clinton, if he had not attacked the judge from Indiana because of his Mexican heritage, if he had not attacked the Khan family, you know, these unforced errors, and I try to resist treating politics as sport. It's not. This is how we govern ourselves. This is how we create possibilities for everyone's life and livelihood. It's a nation devoted to an idea, not an ethnicity. And so I try to resist the sort of glib sports writing way of talking about it. But, you know, had Trump actually decided, I'm going to have a get out the vote operation, I'm going to empower people to really run this campaign, I'm not just going to tweet about Miss Universe, could he have changed the result? And I think the answer is yes. But it's going to be a question for historians.
Well,
I don't plan to be one of them.
Oh, you never know. But you should have, you know, in your backpack carried a couple copies of your book, and you could have signed them. We have so many presidential histories. You could have given them to him and said, Mr. Trump, my gift to you.
I hope another missed opportunity.
I know.
Where were you when I needed you?
I hope you'll read what I've written. Our phone number, we welcome phone calls. John Meacham is our guest. He was last with us talking about his latest book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush, which is a wonderful read, very, very complete. And it's now out in paperback. He's going to be in Milwaukee at Boswell on Sunday night at 7 o'clock. It should be a highly interesting conversation. He's a presidential historian, Andrew Jackson in the White House, also author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of Epic Friendship. He is Pulitzer Prize winning author, did I say that? Executive Vice President and Executive Editor at Random House. Wrote a really interesting piece that we found for Time, What a President Needs to Know Amid the Clamor of Advisors and the Fog of Hard Calls, Some Basic Requirements Remain. We'll get further into that as we carry on. He's a contributing editor at Time. Here's our phone number. Lines are open for you. It's kind of a wide-ranging conversation as we're, how many days now? 6 days from the election. Which really has gone on forever, hasn't it? Just 6 days. So all you can talk about the FBI, deal with him, whether or not the FBI needs to investigate the Trump campaign's connections with Russia, what you make of latest polls that are out. It's okay. It's all on the table this hour for John. He knows history and he knows what's happening day to day. He reads the newspapers and he reads books. And he writes books. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, where we love to read your messages always, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Meacham is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls, John, with Mary in Milwaukee. Hello, Mary.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen. Pleasure to talk to you, John Meacham. Read your books and enjoyed them. I guess my concern is, or my question is, what do you think a Trump cabinet would look like?
Have you ever seen Star Wars? Remember the bar scene in the first episode? I think it's hard to say. Obviously, I think that there would be some establishment Republicans who would feel a certain obligation to try to help a novice president govern. But I think there would be also some people who would want to stay as far away from it as possible. So I don't think you would be attracting the kind of talent that a more conventional Republican politician, Republican president, would be able to attract.
The other thing you remind us of, you have interesting reflections that Harry Truman gave us and JFK concerning what the presidency is, and Truman talking about you not knowing what's going to happen to a man or a woman until he gets to a place of responsibility. And JFK, it's hard to imagine Trump in this situation. You have all these advisors, and from what you've written, he would listen to a lot of different people, but you stand alone at what Kennedy described as the vital center of action, and you wonder what will happen. Don't you?
You know, it that's always been true. It's President Kennedy was writing and thinking and being president at the, not the dawn, but sort of the middle, the end of the beginning, I guess, of the nuclear age. And that's really what he was talking about. You know, there is a commander in chief. There are checks and balances, but functionally, you know, the war making power has become ever more the province of the executive and ever more the province of one person. And that's a hugely important thing to bear in mind here. I think that both Truman and Kennedy left these really interesting. I've always collected sort of presidents talking about what it's like to be president, which you know nobody else knows. So it's a worthwhile question. Truman thought that, as you just suggested, that you never really know what a person is going to do in a position of responsibility, whether it's running a farm or a bank or a country, until they get there, and that all you can do is judge their views on present events and try to make a guess. You know, if people have been making a guess about him on the afternoon of April 12th, 1945, they would not have thought that he was probably going to be much of a president. He's now revered.
Yes.
And I think that part of that was something of a reflection of his own thoughts about his own historical journey. But, you know, Kennedy was right. Kennedy wrote a piece. It was the foreword to a book of Ted Sorensen's just shortly before, about 2 months before the assassination in 63, in which he said that the president of the United States, people talk about the loneliness of the office, but no man in America is the object of more clamorous counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Yet at the end of the day, truly, it is his decision to make. And what Mr. Trump has not demonstrated really is he able to sift through advice to reach a decision, or does he have an intuitive view that is then impossible to budge because he values intuition over experience? And that's a real question for voters.
Do you think it's important and maybe vitally important for a president to know American history pretty thoroughly, to know what other presidents have done, John?
I think they need, you know, it's sort of a softball for me because I would say, of course, you know,
yes.
But you can also make too much of it. I mean, here's what I think. I've never been a political practitioner, but what I would want to know if I were was basically what had worked and what had not in the past and why, because I would want to emulate that which worked and avoid that which did not. And so I would want to understand the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to understand FDR's very slow movement of the country into World War II. I would want to understand how emancipated the slaves, which was an incredibly complicated political and military decision in order to understand how I might, as president, be able to handle a difficult and complicated task. So I don't think you have to be a PhD. I think it probably helps not to be. But I do think it's a little bit like, you know, you want your doctor to be well-read in the literature of the field, right? So that when he sees certain symptoms, he knows, you know, what's going on. That's the way I see history in the presidency. You want them to be able to have a diagnostician's familiarity with it so that they can at least avoid the obvious pitfalls. We're all going to make mistakes. We're all going to screw up. Every president's going to do something totally boneheaded. Sometimes by design, I mean, sometimes purposely, sometimes by mistake. But, you know, you want them to get just one or two more right than they get wrong. And I do think that a historical sensibility helps, like any of us, you know, like in our own lives. I mean, you know what kinds of shows work for you. You know what kind of, things the devices, the questions that elicit a good answer or not a good answer. So you know that history. You don't just start every day thinking this is my first broadcast.
No, it's definitely not my first broadcast.
Trump tends to start each day as if it's his first day running for president, and that's a difference.
You mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I think about the advice that President Kennedy was receiving and a real desire on the part of many generals to take military action, which could have been disastrous as we look at it now, and his having to make that decision ultimately by himself that was contrary, really, to a lot of the advice he was receiving.
He and his brother, Bobby Kennedy, were desperately trying to keep their options open. They understood a critical element of military and diplomatic strategy, life strategy, I would argue, which is you always leave your opponent a face-saving way out. Total victory sounds good on paper, but it rarely works in life. They needed Khrushchev to have a way out. They did compromise. We did give up our Jupiter missiles in Turkey. And they were able to manipulate the timing in a way that it was advantageous to the United States. But what's remarkable, Bay of Pigs, and this is what you hope in any president and any person, is, you know, Kennedy had come into office and immediately authorized the Bay of Pigs invasion, which had been a disaster. And he said, you know, in a parliamentary system, I would resign. He was bereft. And he reached out to Dwight Eisenhower. They were not close, trust me. And it was very painful for the 44-year-old president, Democratic president, who had been a lieutenant junior grade in the Navy during World War II, to call the 71-year-old former supreme allied commander of the forces that liberated Europe, two-term president, to say, I screwed up, how do I learn from this? And part of Eisenhower's advice was you have to keep everybody in the room. You have to keep the options flowing. You can't just decide without argument. And that was one of the reasons that the executive committee of the National Security Council, XCOM, which met for 13 days, and they made great movies about it, title of RFK's book on it. The missile crisis is one of the great American sagas. Arthur Schlesinger once referred to, I think, the middle Saturday as the most dangerous hour in human history, because we were so close to it. And it's almost almost impossible to imagine it would have been a limited exchange. I suspect that if an offensive missile had been launched, I fear that it would have triggered a global thermonuclear war.
Mary, thanks for calling. Joe in Green Bay, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. Love it. Trump keeps saying that Hillary should go to prison and so forth. This is before even a trial or anything like that. I'm just curious if the speaker has any insight into what Donald Trump has already been convicted of or settled or what he's admitted to. How many past cases has Trump been involved in? What is his role in the legal system as a defendant and or a plaintiff? How many has he won? How many has he lost? Do we really want that kind of person in the White House who's going to be on trial in December? Two separate cases, plus all the stuff in the past, which is probably old news, but still, I think it's relevant because it displays Trump's character.
Thanks, Joe, for the call. John?
You know, he's a New York real estate developer, so litigation is his middle name. It's a litigious business. I think even by that standard, though, he's had an extraordinary number of cases. I don't know the numbers offhand. I'm sure those are easily available. You're caller's right about, you know, their ongoing lawsuits. And we don't know what all is being investigated. I mean, that's part of the, I mean, there's this question about Paul Manafort and Russia and, you know, the headquarters and all of that. And I simply don't know enough to know exactly what's happening there. But there's no doubt that Trump is a contentious, litigious figure. And there would almost certainly be continuing fallout from that contentious and litigious past if he were to become president.
Thanks, Joe, for your call. Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Oh, yes. Good afternoon. Say, in response to Dr. Meacham's comments earlier about if Mr. Trump had done this, that, or the other thing, Mr. Trump has done what he has done, and we see him for what he is by way of what he has done. And we need to, as a country, consider whether or not we want a man of this character actually representing our country. We're at a precipice right now, I suspect, as to which way our country could go. And the continuation of our country as a rich and meaningful and ongoing democracy, or a country that is becoming divided in so many ways and areas. And I think what we really need at this time within the country is someone leading us, is someone who is a critical thinker, a rational evaluator, someone that moves with intent, but considering all options.
Mm-hmm. All right, Reed. Thank you. John?
As we say in the South, amen. You know, I think that's right. We would benefit from that. And I think I was exactly right. I mean, my point about Trump and the if he'd done this, if he'd done that, was a counterfactual historical question. No, I don't think there's any doubt what Trump is. I do think there's a doubt about what he actually believes, because I don't know how much of what he says he actually believes, because I think he's fundamentally an opportunist. But that tells you all you need to know. I mean, he was a Democrat until, you know, a very short time before. And I think it's important to remember, I can't imagine that there are many undecided listeners for you right now, but I think it is important to remember that his true entry onto the national stage in this most recent chapter of his life was based on a lie, was based on the birther conspiracy about President Obama. And part of the issue, circling back to what we were talking about earlier, about the culture and about just how fast things burn. I mean, the Comey thing feels like 6 weeks ago now, and it was 4 days, right?
Right.
Does anybody remember the debates? You know, I mean, it's just, it's incredible how rapidly the digitization and the commoditization, mm-hmm. really, of news and information has sped up the pace of political life, not real life necessarily. But and I just don't know. The only thing I can think of is the only cost to this is there somehow a lag between where the political class is in terms of reporting and forming impressions and where a broad swath of voters might be? hard to know. I will say this, too. I'm a Southerner, live in Tennessee. Trump carried 94 out of 95 counties in the primary. He'll unquestionably carry Tennessee. And there is a case to be made that the traditional techniques of polling are not truly capturing what might be his support. There are a lot of anxious white voters in the country, and if they are truly motivated, I think that his support could be higher than is reflected.
We had, and Wisconsin is a bit of an outlier in this regard because this state went for Ted Cruz by a pretty large margin. But today, a fairly reliable poll came out, the last one before the election, that does show Hillary Clinton 6 points ahead in the state of Wisconsin. And I know a lot more money has been poured into this state in days because Republicans thought maybe they had a chance. The Senate race is incredibly close between Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson, but it seems to indicate, at least here, and I'm wondering if we can say that this may be true in other places, that there are a lot of Republicans who are not voting for Trump who will be voting for the Republican Senate candidate. They just have not warmed to him in this state.
I think that's highly possible. And I think it might be true in Florida. I think it might be true in Missouri. I think it might be true in North Carolina, New Hampshire. I don't know where I'd put my nickel right now about where the Senate goes. It could end up tied. That would be a nice way to end this crazy year, wouldn't it?
Sure.
Tim Kaine could become the most popular guy ever, and he's going to need something to do. Can you imagine, just parenthetically, a worse job in America than being vice president when Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are living in the White House? I can't imagine anything worse. I mean, he's going to be cutting the grass. So maybe that'll give him more to do.
John Meacham is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls in our remaining minutes with him. 800-486-8655 is the number. I do want to remind you, he's in Milwaukee on Sunday night at the terrific Boswell Books, and he will be talking about his latest book, which is now out in paperback, and it's a wonderful read, as all his books are, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Obviously, to do a history of a president takes a whole lot of time, many years on his part, and it's really quite good. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, actually. He's the author of American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, awarded... John was the Pulitzer for that biography in 2009. Also author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship. And he's with us this hour. We have a line open. If you'd like to be with us on the air, the number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow, and this is the Ideas Network. Okay, back to phone calls for John Meacham, and we go to Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to get your guest take on my summation is that Trump as a candidate is actually a result of the political class not actually delivering real solutions towards the frustration and problems of the American people. Additionally, I think he's actually going to win because I believe that a large African-American population is going to vote for him because they are way more comfortable with his bombastic style than us prissy upper-middle-class white people.
I don't think there are going to be too many African-Americans voting for him. The Times article today, the front page story, is that African-Americans are failing to vote at the large levels they did when Barack Obama was on the ticket. That voting block, at least for now, John, is down.
It is, and it's an interesting interesting development. On the first part of the point, yes is the answer. Trump is very much the result of a political class, a Congress, and a presidency that has not continued to create sufficient economic growth and maintain the doors of opportunity for a broad number of Americans. There's no question about that. You know, we have a middle class in serious trouble. The creation of the great American middle class after World War II is one of the great achievements of history. And we have not maintained it. And it's that's for a number of reasons, globalization, chiefly. And one of the things that free market people, you know, if you believe in democratic capitalism, you know, you have to believe in it on its when it's not working for you as well as when it is working for you. And so, you know, what Adam Smith giveth, Adam Smith taketh away. And we're in the latter phase right now. But I don't think there's any question. I think that Trump is where Trump is because there's not enough job growth in the country. And people believe that the political leadership has a role to play in creating the climate for that job growth.
Richland Center and Mark. Hi.
You mentioned that you wrote a book about Jackson, and Jackson ran on a platform of eliminating the private creation of money by way of the national bank. It wasn't really national. It was a private entity, and presently 97%+ of all the money that's in circulation gets created by banks because the nation itself will not create money. And so the question really, if we would like to see Clinton not be at the behest of Wall Street, then the creation of money itself needs to return back to either just a tracking thing that goes on by the people, or at least in the case of Ellen Brown's suggestion, that money be nationalized.
John.
It's an interesting point. I'm not an economist, as my wife will be the first to tell you. So I don't know about what we should do now. You're exactly right about the Jacksonian legacy. Jackson believed, had a very pure Republican, lowercase r, view of American society and politics. He believed that intermediary institutions tended to sap the strength of the country, created corruption, not just graft, but in the 18th and 19th century of corruption, meaning health that was diseased. If you had a bank that was, as you point out correctly, you know, the Bank of the United States was a private institution with private shareholders that held government's money and threw off private profit off government money for those shareholders. The bank would hire members of Congress on retainer. It was a large, Jackson used to call it a hydra of corruption. It may not have been quite a hydra, but there were plenty of questions raised. And monetary, you know, the monetary question is essential. I don't know enough about what we should do now. But I got to say, I think I would trust, I would hope that in the wake of 08-09, that anything we do in that zone, we do with great care and quite slowly.
Let's end the hour with thoughts about George Herbert Walker Bush, because you'll be talking about him and other things when you come to Milwaukee. You write, he's a voice from a past at once distant and close at hand, and a voice we should seek to heed, for we need that grace now in our own time.
Yeah.
Why should we heed
his voice? It.
You believe?
I believe it because he was a man. He was the last president of the World War II generation, first president of the post-Cold War era. And he made mistakes. He opposed the 64 Civil Rights Act. He ran against Dukakis on furloughs and pledges of allegiance. And he didn't take campaign rhetoric seriously enough. He thought being Read My Lips was not as, you know, he thought saying Read My Lips was something that he could get away with. But let's look at him in the whole. This is a man who, when the Berlin Wall fell, refused to go to Berlin to celebrate because he knew it would make Mikhail Gorbachev's job harder. And Mikhail Gorbachev's job was to end the Soviet Union. It's a man who created a culture of compromise and consensus that passed the Clean Air Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. I've been out talking about this book for a year now, and I've had on almost 10 occasions quite severely disabled people come up to me, often in very elaborate wheelchairs, and say, if it weren't for George Bush, I couldn't have come into this building, or I couldn't have gone to school. he's a man who was driven by ambition, no question about it, but who ultimately did whatever he had mm-hmm. to do, in many cases, to amass power. But once he had power, he did, by and large, put the country first as he best understood it.
Thank you, John Meacham, so much. We're out of time. We'll see you on Sunday at 7 o'clock, Boswell Books. Thank you for all you do.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
John Meacham, he'll be at Boswell on Sunday at 7. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and to Zeb Gozman for production and on-air production for this hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers as well, and thank you for listening.